For this year's Good Friday sermon, I want to link together three encounters as we reflect on the hours leading up to Jesus' execution. I want us to think about Pilate, the Roman governor, who had the final say in whether Jesus would live or die. I want us to think about Herod, the playboy king who wanted to see Jesus do some tricks. And then I want us to think about Jesus himself as he knelt in Gethsemane, grappling with the spectre of what lay ahead. And I want to use the word surrendering to connect those three encounters together. In truth, I'm riveted by all the characters in those final hours. Peter, who declared unquenchable loyalty to Jesus, but then went on to deny all knowledge of him, not just once, but three times. And those fascinating words in a few of the Gospels following Jesus' arrest, Peter followed at a distance. Doesn't it conjure something in your mind? And John, he was an interesting character, and it seems was also a friend of the high priest, says so in John 18:15. So he was also present in the courtyard while Jesus was being tried and Peter was denying all knowledge. How come he didn't speak up? That's always fascinated me. Simon of Cyrene is another one, the unnamed centurion, Joseph of Arimathea, and so on. So many different characters. But for now, let's just stick with Pilate, Herod, and Jesus himself as we develop this theme of surrendering. Pilate, I think I feel some degree of sympathy for Pilate. He was in a no-win situation. He was the Roman governor of Judea, so he was an intruder into Jewish life. His job was to make sure that people paid their taxes and to keep the peace. Now, he was being told that this innocent man was a freedom fighter, and that inaction on his part amounted to a dereliction of duty. Meanwhile, his wife was whispering in his ear that she had had bad dreams about Jesus and he shouldn't get involved. In the end, the religious authorities gathered a mob shouting, "Crucify him," and he succumbed to pressure. It's easy enough to be critical, isn't it? But surrendering to pressure from those around us is nothing new. When you're a teenager, the last thing you want is to stand out from the crowd. It's all about fitting in, wearing the right clothes, having the right phone, not becoming the object of ridicule. History does throw up some great names of people who stood out from the crowd, but not many of us want to stick our heads above the parapet. When J.B. Phillips, an Anglican clergyman, read the New Testament to his young people during the early days of World War II, he found that they struggled to understand the language of the King James Version. So he spent some of the time in the air raid shelters to produce a contemporary translation of the New Testament. In the end, it took him over 15 years. It was completed in 1958. And you can read it. You can get your copy. You can even read it online. And perhaps for me, one of his most enduring lines is Romans 12, verse 2, and his rendering of that verse, where Paul writes, "Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold, but let God remake you." Aren't those just brilliant words? Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold. Pilate remains in our imagination as the one who surrendered to pressure, who preferred a quiet life, who opted to debate truth rather than to live by it. And then Herod, King Herod. Luke tells us that King Herod was in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus' trial. The Romans had made him responsible for the province of Galilee. We already know bits about him from the story of John the Baptist. By all accounts, he was a bit of a sermon taster. He enjoyed listening to John, but at the same time, he found what John said unsettling. And John had been particularly critical of his marriage to Herodias. Herodias had been his brother Philip's wife, and on a visit to Rome, Herod had seduced her and smuggled her onto the boat back to Galilee. John simply called it for what it was, adultery, and that's why he was imprisoned and eventually beheaded. He got underneath Herod's skin. Now, if Herod had any conscience at all, by the time he met Jesus, it seems to have deserted him. Pilate sent him to Herod because Jesus came from Galilee. But Herod was not interested in Pilate's agenda. He'd heard that Jesus was a miracle worker, and so he wanted to see Jesus do something clever. You know, pull a rabbit out of a hat, divide the waters in his swimming pool, make his receding hairline grow back again. But Jesus wouldn't cooperate. Luke tells us that Jesus was silent. Herod's conscience was so seared that his ears were closed to the truth. If Pilate's fault was that he surrendered to pressure, then Herod had surrendered his soul to the pursuit of pleasure. He wanted to be entertained by Jesus. And he's not so different from the majority of us. We don't want to spend our lives fighting some cause, taking on inconvenient challenges. We want to laugh, to have a good time, to live the dream. So come now to Jesus and to his prayer in Gethsemane. Father, if it's possible, I don't want to drink from the cup you're handing me, but I'll do it if that's what you really want. What an interesting prayer that is. In some ways, this short time in Gethsemane represented Jesus' final chance to get away, not to fulfill his destiny. He could have done a runner, fled Jerusalem, laid low for a few weeks, and then started a new life for himself somewhere safe. But if, as we Christians believe, Jesus' death was more than just a martyrdom, that he was dying for the sins of the world, that the agony of being crucified paled into insignificance compared to the spiritual sacrifice he would have to endure, then you'll understand why his sweat was like thick drops of blood. He was being asked to surrender to a destiny far too complex for me to put into words. He was about to enter the depths of spiritual forsakenness. He was far beyond worrying about social pressure like Pilate. He'd never been self-indulgent like Herod, but now he was being called upon to do something so awful that even he shrank back and struggled. There are plenty of challenges that we could take for ourselves, but Good Friday is about Jesus, not us. It's about appreciating the depths of his agony. In Jerusalem, there's a valley between the Mount of Olives and the city itself. Back in 2010, our church group descended the steep steps of the mount, and then at the bottom we found ourselves in that garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, the garden where Jesus prayed. There's a church there, the Church of All Nations, and inside the church there's a large expanse of stone with rails around it. It's known as the Rock of the Agony, and it's believed that that's where Jesus prayed, and his sweat was like great drops of blood. And Christian pilgrims come and kneel and reflect on what Jesus went through. When we were there, the crowds were bustling, and for me it was no place for quiet reflection. But I could recall an old friend telling me about his visit there back in the 1980s. And as he knelt, he said that he heard an audible voice with these simple words, "All this for you." Today, some churches will be singing the hymn, "O Sacred Head, Sore Wounded." The hymn has gone through several changes over the years, and I leave you with this verse. "Your sinless soul's oppression was all for sinners' gain. Mine was the transgression, but yours the deadly pain. I bow my head, my Saviour, for I deserve your place. O grant to me your favour, and heal me by your grace." There are many Pilates and Herods in the world, surrendering their souls on the altars of conformity and self-indulgence. But there is only one Jesus. We pay homage to him this morning.